Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive. Hi, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called How to Sell Consulting Services to Doctors, Secrets Every HMA Consultant Should Know About Marketing Consulting Services to Doctors. Jeff has been a successful marketing consultant in the medical field for years. Although he admits he's made every mistake in the book, he also says his success has come from studying the fundamentals of marketing, and as a result, he's helped save a hospital from closing, helping laser manufacturers sell their expensive equipment to doctors, and help doctors know how to have successful money-making medical centers. Jeff specializes in lasers, and because laser treatments are expensive and require more than one visit, Jeff always pre-qualifies his prospects and gives away free consultations. And in this two-part audio, you'll hear how he gets a 92% conversion rate. Part 1 is called Sometimes You Have to Take Risks. Jeff's consulting practice didn't succeed overnight. In fact, he started out in the billing department of a small hospital, and although he eventually became very successful running laser centers, he felt like he never had the time for his family. So he made the risky decision to try consulting and has never looked back. And in Part 1, you'll hear all about his amazing story along with the lessons he's learned along the way, including why Jeff believes and building a team and how he keeps everybody motivated and on task, how Jeff uses his staff to help him save a dying hospital and happened upon an idea that changed his life, how he convinces doctors that they need to market their centers beyond the typical Yellow Pages ad, the marketing techniques Jeff learned from Jay Abraham and how he applied them to his work, how Jeff landed his biggest marketing success by accident with a combination of paid advertising and free publicity. There's a lot to be learned in this interview, especially if you're planning on marketing to doctors. Now let's get ready, and here's Part 1. We've got consultants all over the world. They're out there selling and hustling marketing consulting services. And I get a lot of questions from my consultants, you know, are doctors good marketing consulting prospects? And I don't really know. Richard, the expert, says they can be tough. And just from our conversation, I think you would probably agree to that. But before we get into all that, let's just keep the consultants in mind. Out there looking for a potential new market for consulting services using our HMA system, and you can shed some light on your history and what you've been able to do, and there's a lot of great lessons for our consultants to hear, especially how you structured and positioned yourself as a training expert for your niche market, and we'll just share some ideas, and maybe they can learn from you, and we can let them know about what you're doing as well. So when did you first get bitten by the marketing bug? Take me back. When did all this start? What were you doing?
Well, I worked in hospital finance for 15 years or so before getting involved with marketing.
What was hospital finance? What did that mean?
Hospital finance, I was director of patient financial services at 3 different Boston area hospitals, specializing in smaller hospitals. I worked for Kennedy Children's Hospital, which was a wonderful hospital to be working at, for 6 years. And then after that, I left that job, a job that I actually loved, and went to a new hospital called Brookline Hospital. I was there 2 days when they announced they were going to close. So you can imagine. Now, the interesting part of that story is that I was one of the very last people to ever leave. Because I worked in the financial section, we had to stay on.
Now, when you say financial section, were you collecting money or helping patients pay?
Patient financial services was the credit and collection department reported to me. The billing department reported to me. So collecting the money from third parties, and then, of course, anything that went into credit and collection, as well as dealing with all of the different third-party payers, the insurance companies, Medicaid, Medicare, all of that.
That's a big job, too.
Yeah, and cash flow was critical because they were smaller hospitals. We took a very team-type approach to credit and collection, to billing. We had goals, and we had to meet those, and it was a wonderful learning experience. You know, I liked it, but you could see that the handwriting was on the wall for small hospitals because the healthcare industry was changing dramatically at that time. Things called DRGs was coming out, and just the way you were paid. So, for instance, Blue Cross could approach the hospital and they could say to us, because we're a small hospital, we're going to pay you 45 cents on the dollar for what you bill because you had individual contracts with them. Now, if they were a large hospital like Boston Medical Center, they could pay them 78 cents. So you negotiate your contract directly with many of the different payers, and being a small hospital, you're at a huge disadvantage because they wanted to set up systems with the larger hospitals, of course. So you knew that the small hospitals couldn't survive.
Right. So this one, 2 days after you started, announced that they were going down, but you stayed on because you had to still collect money.
And I had to negotiate some of the final contracts with some of the payers. There were millions of dollars on the table. So what ended up happening is what seemed like the worst possible thing that could ever happen to me, leaving a job that I loved, that I was very successful at for 6 years, turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me because they needed people that understood finance. So everybody else left, all the doctors, all the nurses, all the medical people left. I was there for 2 more years. Collecting all the money that was owed to the hospital and helping negotiate the contracts. And I was able to bring my own people in, and we were collecting the money like an in-house collection agency for a percentage of what we collected.
Did you and your own people negotiate the percentage? You were like independent collection agency for the hospital?
Yeah, I was in that position. I ended up buying my house on that job.
That's awesome. Can I ask, what did you negotiate percentage-wise?
We negotiated 12%.
That's pretty good. And how much debt was out there? How much was owed?
Oh, millions. It was millions.
And so you worked it for 2 years?
Yes, for 2 years.
That's beautiful. That opportunity is still available.
Absolutely.
I've always kind of been interested in that. All that debt out there, if you know how to collect. You know, I've got a great interview on my site with Bill Bartman. Have you heard of him?
No.
Bill Bartman was once a billionaire, and he started collecting money. He started collecting from his kitchen table back in, I don't know if it was the 70s or 80s, when the FDIC was selling all the bad debt. This is a fascinating interview. It's right up your alley from what you used to do. And now all the banks are failing, and he's teaching people how to buy this debt from the banks and the companies that dispose of all the debt and the FDIC and how to go into business collecting on it.
Really?
Yeah. It's interesting stuff. I'll send you the link after we do the interview. It's a fascinating interview. He made $1 billion, had a huge company, and then there was some legal stuff that went down, and he had to drop out of the company. He had a lot of bad experiences. So for 2 years, you collected a lot of money.
Collected the money for the hospital. I was one of the last people to leave before the wrecking ball actually came in.
Well, what was the wrecking ball?
They knocked the hospital down.
Oh, they did.
It was a gorgeous hospital. It was called Brookline Hospital, and it was on a beautiful piece of land. It was really a premier hospital to be a patient in, actually, in the 90s and prior to that. But, of course, because it couldn't stay open, now the hospital's empty, and they developed the land for, I believe, what were called life centers at the time, you know, where people come in and buy a condo-type living environment and that type of thing. But, no, they demolished the hospital, so I was there right up to the very end. And because I specialized in working in smaller hospitals, my closest friend was the CEO of the hospital, and he had moved on to another hospital that had problems, another small hospital right on Commonwealth Avenue in Boston, a hospital called Hahnemann Hospital. Again, a 110, 120 bed hospital. They had huge problems with collections, with billing, with almost every financial aspect of the hospital, and he asked me to now come over there and work with him again. This would be the third job we worked on. So I went over there to work at the Hahnemann Hospital.
Did you negotiate a better deal?
Yes.
You did 12% on the last one?
Well, I was finished with that job, so now it was time to move on and go back into the actual hospital employee.
Oh, so you went in as an employee now?
I went in as an employee, as the director of patient finances.
Was that hard to go in as an employee when before you were pretty much your own man?
Yeah, but I knew what I was getting into. I knew the people. I knew my boss very well. We had worked together at Kennedy Children's for the 6 years. He was the man that recruited me to go to Brookline. What was so strange is my best friend asked me to come over to this hospital, and I find out 2 days later they're going to close it. I'm like, didn't you know?
Did he know?
No, he didn't know. They kept it from him. But again, that experience turned into one of the better experiences for me personally, because I was able to take what I had learned from the Kennedy and apply it there. And like I said, I was there at the very end. So it worked out very well for me. I felt a little bit that I owed him. So I went over to work at this nightmare of a hospital, actually, from the financial point of view, to help him out. And I remember when we arrived there, days in accounts receivable were 146 days of accounts receivable.
What are the chances of getting that? Pretty slim?
And none.
At 140 days?
It's ridiculous. It shows you that there's no system in place at all to collect the money or to bill it properly. And a small hospital lives and dies on cash flow. Well, at 146 days to get a bill paid, you could see the kind of problem they had. But that was my specialty, and I brought other people in that I knew, and we turned it around.
Were you able to collect on some of that older debt?
Some of it, and some of it you lose.
You do?
Yeah. You have to kind of come in and go fresh. In other words, we're going to get collections on new stuff right away.
I don't want to go too far off the track, but when it comes to collections, where's the magic time period that's going to give you the best chance of collecting?
You know, anything under 90 days.
And then after 90 days, it's severely difficult?
Yeah, it really starts getting very old, and you need more people to be able to go back and research what was the issue. And insurance companies are great at not paying bills.
So this debt, even with insurance, you couldn't even collect from insurance companies at that debt?
You could, but it just took a lot of work. Again, we're talking about sometimes, you know, it depended on the amount, so you had to prioritize which one you're going to go after, and of course you would do that by how much the original bill was. And then what is the payment on account factor? In other words, are you going to get 80 cents on the dollar or 20 cents on the dollar? So there's a lot of issues, and they had a staff there that didn't know what they were doing. Nothing was really automated. There were all kinds of problems. So I had to go in there and try to fix that.
And I think I see where you're going. You had to put a marketing system in place.
Absolutely.
So this is where it's kind of starting, right?
Yeah. What I believe in doing is building a team. A team of people that are vested, that really have goals. And that's what we did there. We did the exact same thing we did at Kennedy. We did the same thing we did at Brookline Hospital. And now it's at Hahnemann Hospital. So we started whittling away.
Just give me a couple important things about building a team. And what keeps them part of the team and motivated?
I believe that everybody in the hospital needs to understand how much it costs to run that hospital every single day. And we used to make sure that everybody knew this is the amount of money we need to bring in every day to keep this place going, for you to get a raise next year, for us to get equipment. You have to give people a lot of information, and usually they don't have that. And then I like just having a reward system for the billing department, getting the people out of there that didn't want to work, and there were a lot of them.
And you just said, see you later, clean them out.
Later. And replacing them with people that I knew that were team-orientated. People that wanted to win and understood what the game was and why they were doing it. And, you know, I had been lucky because I found those people over the years. And so I was able to bring a couple of them in and take a few of the people that actually were already there and turn their thinking around. Why are we doing this? Why is this important? Because a lot of people don't know it's important.
Were they in salary or salary plus like some kind of commission based on results?
No, it was just salary.
Straight salary, okay. Yeah.
But, of course, because my boss was the CFO and later the CEO of the hospital, their raises depended on that. If we could bring days on accounts receivable down, he understood very well the importance of cash flow. It's impossible to keep the hospital open without proper cash flow. And so people could get promotions that way. They could build up their resumes that way and move on to other jobs. So I did take some people in-house that had at least the potential of doing this, of pulling this off, and they were promoted through the system. So we were able to take the receivables down slowly, but eventually we started knocking days on receivables off at fairly large clips. Then what ended up happening is, in a small hospital, you can play a lot of roles. We put action teams together in the hospital that addressed various issues of a small hospital, like space, for instance. Space is always a problem. So there was an action team for space and how we would use space or develop it. Well, my role, my boss put me in charge of new business development. And what ended up happening to this particular hospital is they were about to lose a very large part of their outpatient revenue. This was eye surgeries. The eye surgeons back in the late 80s started to develop their own little surgery centers and build those out and leave the hospital environment and start doing everything for themselves.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com.
Yeah, in their own offices.
Yeah. So we had a very large group of eye surgeons that were about to leave our hospital, which was critical to this small hospital. If they lose that revenue, now they're really in trouble.
Eye surgery brought in a lot of revenue.
A lot. From outpatient surgery, it was a big piece. So we had to somehow come up with a way of offsetting that. So what I did was I met with all of the department heads, and I asked them to go back to their people, and I asked them to ask people any idea that they had where we could bring new revenue into the hospital, because I believe that the solutions to problems do not only come from management. It could come from any place, and I really do like involving all people. And what I was doing is every week during the lunchtime, that particular hospital had two cafeterias. One was a small one. So I told them that at the small cafeteria on Fridays, anybody that has an idea, the promise is there's no such thing as bad idea, and we will look into every idea seriously that's brought forward by an employee.
What incentive was there for people to submit ideas, any?
There really wasn't an incentive. It was just that we were involving them. We were asking them for their help.
And they responded to that?
And they responded. Because nobody really ever asks the average person in the business, you know, well, what do you think? It's always you go to the managers and you say, what do you think? Like they're the only ones that can think, you know? So we involved everybody. Well, now at this time, just so you understand the progression of things, the accounts receivable in the hospital started getting pretty well in shape, and I had developed some people in the department that were now more managers. My role was decreasing because my role was to come in and stop the bleeding, basically. Put the systems in place, get the thing working, and that was now done. Things were now pretty much in shape, but now we have this big issue of we're losing the eye surgeons. So anyways, this guy comes into the meeting, and he actually worked for one of the departments that reported to me. So I knew the guy pretty well. He came in and said that he had read in Popular Mechanics that they had a laser that could remove tattoos. Well, everybody laughed and said, tattoos, you know, Hell's Angels in the parking lot. And everybody kind of laughed at him, but I had promised that any idea that was brought forward, we would look into it. So that's what he came in and said. So I said, okay, I'll look into it. And I looked into it, and I found a company that was out of England that produced this laser that was removing tattoos. And I went out and met with the company. They actually were only a town away from me from where I lived, and just started to learn a little bit about it. Then after them, I found the name of this other company. It was a very large company called Candela Laser. And Candela Laser was only 20 minutes away from my house, and it's one of the biggest companies in the world, one of the first companies that actually developed lasers for different skin conditions.
You were in Boston, right?
Yeah, Boston area. The western suburb is where I live, and they were also located in the western suburb. So I made an appointment, went over there, and at the time they offered two lasers. And that's really all that was out there at this particular time. But they started giving me materials and, you know, mostly sales materials. And then they also, of course, started giving me white papers and clinical reports and everything. And I started working with the medical director of the hospital, and we started reading this material. And I read everything I could get my hands on about lasers for about 6 months, mostly from Candela. Being a numbers guy, I started to put together the numbers of who would want this. And the lasers at the time, their standard product was a vascular lesions laser.
For like varicose veins and stuff?
Well, they developed the very first laser that was used to treat children born with birthmarks called the Port Weinstein. That was the first laser developed, and this is the company that developed it. To this day, it's the gold standard in the industry. Prior to that time, lasers would scar because all lasers were continuous wavelength, meaning the light that left the laser left on a continuous beam. Depending on how long you let it touch the skin, heat would build up very quickly. Typically burn.
Now they pulsate.
Yes. And this company developed what's called the pulse dye laser, meaning they pulse the light in very, very short bursts, and the heat from the laser would travel through the skin into the target, destroying the target. They're the company that developed that.
Interesting.
Yeah. So they had that product, and then they had a second product called the PLTL laser, which was an alexandrite laser. It was also pulsed, and that laser could remove tattoos, and it could also remove pigmented lesions, brown spots, or brown birthmarks, cafe au lait birthmark, or freckles, or age spots. Their two products combined were blood vessels, vascula, pigmented lesions, brown, or tattoo removals.
And this was back in the 80s at that time?
This was 1990.
Did they have their lasers all over the world?
They had them all over the world. They were a leader, actually, in selling lasers. Now, at the time, the only people they ever sold a laser to would have been a dermatologist. The dermatologist was their primary market.
So they weren't in hospitals?
They were.
If they had a dermatology department?
Yeah. In Boston, there's a place called the Wellman Lab, and that's all the Harvard doctors, and that's where most of the technology was actually developed, was right here in the Boston area. Beth Israel Hospital had a very large laser center, as well as, you know, Chicago, New York, L.A. That's where you would probably find lasers would be in the clinical applications, would be in the larger hospitals. Lasers were very, very expensive when I first got into this.
What did these machines cost at that time?
List price on the vascular laser was $225,000, and on the PLTL laser was $189,000.
Okay, so tell me why you're studying all this. What's your idea? What are you thinking? Using it in the hospital as a revenue source?
Yes, because I had to offset the loss of income, number one. Number two, lasers are self-pay.
What does that mean?
Meaning there's no insurance companies. There's no forms to fill out. There's no discounting like you had to do in healthcare. It isn't Blue Cross coming in and saying, we're going to give you 35 cents on the dollar. It was 100 cents on the dollar. Now, I started putting the numbers together. How many people have a birthmark? How many people have a rosacea, you know, a red face, or an angioma, little red pimples, or telangiectasias, which would be all those little blood vessels on the face? How many people have a brown spot? How many people have a tattoo? I'm starting to run the numbers and starting to think, well, what's the market? How many people are out there? And after doing that, the market was fairly significant. So I went to the board of directors of the hospital, and I recommended that we open up a laser center. Now, long story short, because this wasn't just one meeting, this was many meetings, they eventually approved that we open up the laser center, and they said to me, you are the only one that knows anything about lasers other than the medical director, because he and I were the two that were looking at all this clinical data. He said, you're the only one that knows anything about it. We want you to be the head of the laser center.
Okay.
He ended up being the director of the laser center.
Oh, that's great. At that time, was it ever heard that a hospital had a laser center?
Oh, yes. Mass General, there were many laser centers around me, and there were a few private ones. So there were some out there. This was the beginning of the laser industry, the cosmetic or aesthetic laser industry, what's called today. Now, I am the new director of the laser center here at the hospital. So, of course, I go to the company Candela, and I bought both of their lasers. Now, the funny thing is a little sidebar on this particular story. It's funny how sometimes the entire business or the entire idea hangs on one little balancing point. And for the board of directors, they wanted to talk to somebody that was already running a laser center because they wanted it to be confirmed. Because they said to me, if this is such a great idea, why isn't everybody doing it? And I said to them, everybody will be. I said, this is where the future is going. That's how I looked at it. I could see that in the future, laser procedures and laser technology was going to grow. And I wanted to get on the ground floor of it, not years down the road. But they wanted to speak with somebody that was already running a laser center. So my laser salesman hooked me up with a woman from New York. It was called Genesee Valley Laser Center, and they were very, very successful. And the nurse from Genesee Valley Laser Center flew out here to Boston. We met her at the airport, myself, the president of the hospital, and some of the board of directors. And she confirmed to them that the laser business is a great business. they weren't in New York City, but they were doing very well, and she confirmed all the things that I had basically told them, the potential of this business and the cash flow of this business. She confirmed that to them. So they approved the laser center. Now, the other thing that was hanging on this, the board of directors, because the hospital was cash poor, there was a big project they wanted to do, and they wanted to hardtop the entire parking lot for the hospital, but they didn't have the money to do it. So what I said to them is, I can hardtop the whole hospital parking lot for you if we buy the lasers, because this is what we'll do. We'll buy the lasers at list price. Now, we have a 5-year lease on the lasers. We'll buy the lasers at list price. I will negotiate a discount from the laser company, the discount they would have given me, and they will rebate back to me the cash. We'll take that cash and use that to hardtop the parking lot. And that sealed the deal. That gave them something they wanted. So we were able to take and fold that into the 5-year lease without going out and borrowing the money from another source. So the hospital got a brand new parking lot, I got my laser center, and now I'm the director of the laser center.
What did it cost to hardtop the hospital?
It was about $60,000.
60 grand. And so the two machines were about $500,000?
Let's see, 180, let's call it 190 and 225, and I got about $60,000 off that.
Okay, that's great.
Yeah.
All right, so you're running this laser center.
So I'm running the laser center.
Now you got to figure we need some customers.
Exactly. Now, you never really think about that. You don't, because I've worked in healthcare my whole life, and this is the thing that all of the doctors that I deal with, this is their mentality also. When you work in healthcare, you don't really think about where do people come from. You never do. I ask doctors this all the time in my consulting business. They never sit there and think, how did people come to my waiting room today? Because they work in a referral-based business. Insurance companies refer patients to doctors. Doctors do not have to market or advertise, and their idea of marketing and advertising is the Yellow Pages. The Yellow Pages guy comes in and says, don't worry about it, we'll take care of that for you. And they even write the ad for him. So doctors do not understand marketing or advertising. They don't have to. Why would they? All they know is they're seeing people all day long. And that was basically the same thing with the hospital. I had no background at all in marketing or advertising. I was in finance. So I'm thinking, okay, we get the lasers, we'll have people. And the laser company said, we'll help you because we give you what's called a marketing toolkit. Now, their marketing toolkit consists of radio ads and newspaper slicks, magazine slicks, and letters to send out to other doctors telling them what you're doing. And, of course, they're going to refer everybody over to you is what they're telling you. But they had a little program that was put together by their PR company. So they gave me their marketing toolkit, and I start to use their marketing toolkit.
You didn't know it was no good?
No idea. I thought it was great.
Let me ask you this first. So you couldn't suck off insurance companies for laser business, is that correct?
Not really. The only reimbursable service that we offered occasionally would be the port wine stain birthmark. That could be covered in some cases. Not all insurance companies would cover it, but there were some that would. Everything else would be considered to be not medically necessary, therefore not covered by insurance.
Okay, so this marketing kit was still within the mindset of getting endorsements and referrals from other doctors?
Sure.
Okay.
Or placing newspaper ads, radio ads, and magazines. They gave me pre-done ads that their PR company had come up with.
And you never really questioned whether it worked or not with them?
Well, not at all. I had no idea. I assumed, because they were the company, I assumed, well, of course this will work, because it's done professionally by people that know what they're doing. Well, of course, I realized later they didn't know what they were doing, but I assumed that it did, and I had nothing to base any results on other than the fact that the company was giving it to me. It should work. So I started using their materials. Of course, I came to the realization very quickly that there was one thing and only one thing that would drive the business, and that was marketing, which obviously includes advertising. So this was on me. I'm the guy that went to the hospital board of directors and said this is a good idea, and I believed it was, but I had to make this work. I'm the director of the laser center.
What did you try out of that kit that you got from Candela?
Everything they gave me. I tried newspaper. I tried radio. I tried letters to the doctors. You know, of course, we're thinking they're going to just start referring to us.
Yeah, and nothing happened at all?
Doctors don't refer. Doctors aren't going to take their patient and refer their patient out to somebody they don't know, number one. Number two, technology that they're not even comfortable with or know anything about. And I don't blame them. Why would I take my customer, or patient in this case, and send them to an unknown, not knowing what's going to happen to them? And they turn around and go, you sent me there and these people scarred me with a laser? But see, I didn't know that at the time. So I'm thinking we're going to operate like any medical practice does. I'm going to get referrals all day long. It didn't work like that.
And the advertising didn't pull in anyone?
Well, no, it did. We were very mildly successful. I mean, I was getting some patients, and we were starting to see some people, but nothing like what I had projected.
Did you, like, have in the pit of your stomach, like, you may have really screwed up unless I figure this marketing thing out?
Oh, yeah. Big time. I knew it was on me, and I knew I had to do something about it. And at the time, I had subscribed to a newsletter by Gary North.
Yeah, sure. I know Gary North.
Yeah. Well, Gary North is the first person that I ever heard about Jay Abraham through. Jay Abraham was endorsed by Gary North.
That's right.
And that's how I learned about Jay Abraham, and I started reading, of course, everything I could from this guy, Jay Abraham. This is 1990, and he started talking about a very different type of marketing than what we were doing. Most of the material that I had from the PR company talked about the laser company. It was all talking about how wonderful it was that we were using a Candela laser and on and on and on. How lucky you were to be treated by a Candela product. So Jay obviously piqued my interest, and I knew that I had to start to study, and I knew I had to find the best teacher that I could find. And I said, okay, this is the guy that I'm going to learn from. So I started studying Jay Abraham. Night and day, started studying.
Yeah. Did you go to any of his seminars?
Yes, I did. I went to a number of his seminars. I actually went through a protege program with him.
What year did you go? Either 89, 90, or 91?
Would have been 91, 92, all the way through the 90s. I went to many of his different things. I had probably every course that he's ever done, just because, again, I was getting the mindset that he was teaching is the ultimate financial leverage is marketing. I have to make this successful. So I started studying his material and started using it. And now I had a hospital marketing budget behind me. So, you know, I'm making all the mistakes that you could ever make in marketing. And then I'm learning from him.
What kind of budget could you work with marketing-wise?
Oh, to begin with, it was a very small budget because most of it had to do with mailings to other doctors. And then, you know, each year I'd ask to increase it. Well, what ended up happening a few years down the road is the hospital was sold to an outside group, and the outside group was a group called Vencore, and Vencore's unique strategic advantage was that they did head trauma only. Now, Vencore, what they did is they looked for small hospitals like us because they kind of understood that their customer was not the patient laying in a coma in a bed. It was the loved ones or the visitors, the family. So they would come in to the facility and they would change the look of it to be almost more like a hotel environment. And they could do that with smaller hospitals. So our hospital was approached by them, was bought by them, and Vencore did no outpatient services whatsoever. They only did inpatient services, which meant the laser center, the vast majority of people in the hospital are going to lose their job and all the outpatient services are going to go away. Now, they actually liked our laser center because our laser center was starting to make money, and it was looking good to them. And they almost broke their business model and kept it, but they didn't. So I was able to go to two of the doctors that I was working with. They actually approached me and said, why don't we open up a private laser center? So we did. We moved outside of the hospital with the hospital's blessing. I had a whole database of people, and I took that whole group of people with me, and I opened up my own private laser.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com.
So you did your own lease with Candela for new machinery and everything?
New machinery, went out with the same vendor as well as others, and now this is a few years later, so new lasers were coming on the market, other lasers, and able to treat other conditions and things, so I had a number of different lasers. My first place that I opened up in the hospital was the Laser Center of Boston. When I moved outside, we moved just outside of the city limits of Boston to an area called Chestnut Hill or Newton, Massachusetts. And one of the interesting things about Newton is Newton has the highest per capita income of any city in the United States. And the key is city. Because even though it's small, it's still considered a city, and Newton, the income there is very high. Now, when we moved outside of Boston, I had a big dilemma. The question was, would we change our name or not? We technically were not in Boston any longer. We were now at the point where we were doing very well, and we were thinking in the future about maybe opening up another place or two somewhere. So the question became, do we change our name? We decided to change our name, and we became the Laser Institute of New England. The reason we did that is, and this goes to, should people ever change their name? I was afraid at first to change my name because the Laser Center of Boston had now been around for about 4 years, and we were doing pretty well. But the Laser Institute of New England allowed me to open up additional places, potentially, in the New England area, so that's why I use New England. And institute signifies teaching. We were doing a lot of teaching at this point also. We're starting to get involved in teaching other people. So we became the Laser Institute of New England and moved outside.
When you said you brought over a database from the hospital, what did you have? Just from your previous marketing efforts in the hospital, you were able to bring those names over?
Yes, we brought all of our patients. All of our current patients just came with us.
How many patients did you have at that time? A few hundred?
Oh, more than a few hundred, yeah.
And I know tattoo removal is something. Like with a laser, it's not just a one-time thing.
It's 8 to 12 visits.
So talk about that residual or those multiple visits is what helps financially, right?
Absolutely. And, of course, that goes into the lifetime value, which most people didn't understand. But once I bring in a new patient, customer, client, whatever you want to call them, what's the lifetime value of bringing in a tattoo removal person? And I understood that through J. Abraham, of course, but I never understood that before, which meant that with my marketing in the newspapers and things like this, I was able to measure how much money did I spend and what was my return on that by lifetime value.
Okay, so you've got the Laser Institute of New England set up. You've got one location?
One location originally, and then eventually we were approached by some other people to open up additional centers. And now lasers are becoming very popular, and we were actually approached by some investment people to open up satellite offices. So we had investment people coming in that were talking about giving us a lot of money, because as far as private businesses went, we were probably the largest in all of New England. And we now knew what we were doing. Now, this is now 6 years, 7 years into J. Abraham teaching. Now I knew what I was doing with marketing.
So with marketing, what was the main marketing that really worked? Tell me a couple mistakes you made as you were learning, and then tell me the things that were really working.
Well, as far as mistakes go, I made every mistake you could ever make, and I made them multiple times. And doing the marketing, in other words, taking what was given to me by the laser company and thinking that it was good and going out there and just spending money and hoping for a result but never measuring anything, to me that was the big problem. But the things that worked for us, is that what you're asking me?
Yeah, where did you see some really good results from the stuff you're learning with Jay?
Sure. For instance, if I was marketing tattoo removal, there's two major newspapers at the time in the Boston area, the Boston Globe and the Boston Herald. Now, I had to learn the difference between the two and which one worked best. And again, that goes by testing. And I found that the Boston Herald far exceeded the Boston Globe in new customers. So I advertised tattoo removal in the Boston Herald, and it was very successful there. It was not very successful in the Boston Globe. The two papers are very different from each other. The Herald is more of a blue-collar paper, and the Boston Globe was more of a white-collar paper.
And were you as nitty-gritty down to the page of your ad, the placement of your ad?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of this also had to do with my account reps. There was a huge difference between my account rep from the Boston Herald as the account rep from the Boston Globe. The account rep from the Boston Herald, I felt like she became a friend of mine. She would help me with the placement of my ad. She knew the guys in the setup rooms. You know, she would go back and ask them, will you make sure that his ad gets placed in this area? As opposed to the Boston Globe, the woman just came over, all she could care about was payment.
Where was the best placement, and how big of ads did you go with tattoo removal? What really worked?
Well, we tried many different things, but usually in the general news, as far up the paper as we could on the right-hand side, it worked very, very well.
So what was the call to action? I mean, was it headline tattoo removal and call to action? Was it a phone call?
Yeah. You know, I didn't have to get too fancy with the headline. It was laser tattoo removal. And I had a picture of the ad that worked best for me, and I just kept doing it because it worked. It was one of those, it's kind of like the Norman Rockwell where you have the sailor guy with all the names on his arm. Well, I had my own version of that. And basically I had, you know, an arm with a name on it, like Mary with a line through it, Jane with a line through it.
Yeah.
And then the last one was Darlene. And the woman that worked for me that answered our phones was named Darlene. So it was give Darlene a call. But it was laser tattoo removal, give Darlene a call. It didn't have to be a fancy ad. I didn't have to have a huge ad. It was just in the right paper.
And what days would you run it?
I would run it Thursdays and Sundays.
And what kind of phone calls did it produce?
Oh, we did very, very well with laser tattoo removal.
Every time you ran it on a Thursday or a Sunday, the phones just started ringing?
Absolutely. But the biggest hit that I got was by accident on tattoo removal. There's a FM radio station here, and I did a lot of radio advertising that was less than successful because I didn't know what I was doing. Now, every Monday morning, my phone would ring like crazy from every person that was trying to sell advertising because they would see me in the Sunday paper or whatever it may be, and they'd all call me up and tell me why they were the best radio station for me to be on. They'd bring in their arbitrage. They'd show me their ratings, and, you know, I don't know that much yet about advertising and everything, so it would look good to me. The numbers would look good to me, and I would try them, but I wouldn't get a return on it.
Would you try 30-second spots?
60 seconds usually. And I tried many different approaches. I'd have the man and the woman, and, you know, they would help me write the ad. Again, this is while I'm learning, and I'm learning from Jay. Now I'm learning what works, what doesn't, but that's why I always say I made every mistake you can ever make. Later on, when I started to understand a little bit more, through study, really, I had a woman come in, and she had a tattoo on her ankle. I forget what it was, but Alice in Wonderland, I think, tattoos. Well, she happened to mention to me that she worked in the traffic department at a radio station, which was a huge radio station here in Boston. It's called WBCM. Now, WBCM is the first FM station ever in the United States. It's a very large radio station with a huge following. Rock. It's straight rock. She works in the traffic department. Her name is Dina. I'll never forget it. And she comes in with her little tattoo on her ankle. So I said to Dina, "Dina, I'll remove your tattoo for free if you do my radio spot for me, a testimonial." Because what I had learned is there's only one way to do radio, and it's a testimonial. Everything else I did just didn't work.
Okay, so Vina would do a spot. Hi, I'm Vina. I work at the station in the traffic department. I went over to the Laser Institute of New England, and they removed my tattoo.
Yes.
30-second or 60-second?
60 seconds. That does my commercial for me.
In her own voice?
In her own voice.
And is she on the air traffic?
Oh, no. Well, see, this is how much of a rookie I was. I thought traffic meant that she actually did, like, traffic reports as far as how the automobiles on the road were doing.
Yeah.
Realized that traffic meant she was the one that said what time your ad will run.
Oh, she just told you what time any of the advertisers would run.
Well, she was in the traffic department. Traffic department schedules the spots.
It has nothing to do with the reports of the traffic on the street.
Nothing at all. But
oh.
I didn't know that.
Well, that's what I thought you were talking about.
Right, but I didn't know that, so I'm thinking, well, geez, traffic, but her role was much more important because, of course, if I'm buying Morning Drive, that's a very expensive radio spot. Morning Drive is 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. I don't want 6 a.m. I want 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. There's a huge difference between who's listening at real drive time between 7 and 9. If you're paying the same amount of money and you're getting put at 9:45 in the morning, you're not getting nearly the same listening.
So where's the sweet spot? Best time is what?
Is between 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock in the morning, 7 to 9. You're getting much more for your money than you are between 6 and 7 and 9 and 10. But you're paying the same thing. So Dina controls that. So Dean is doing my advertising for me. Now, here's the strange thing that happened is Dina said in her advertisement, I let her just do it in her own voice, said, hi, this is Dina from WBCN Radio, and I know what it's like to have something in my body I don't want. I have this tattoo, and I'm going to the Laser Institute in New England, and blah, 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 blah. Anyways, the number one disc jockey on the radio station picked up on what she said, and I guess they were kind of friends. Mm-hmm. Dina was kind of hot, and he cut out her voice. And all of a sudden, you started hearing on the radio station, hi, this is Dina. I know what it's like to have something in my body I don't want. And he started goofing on her. Now, I'm getting all of this, hi, this is Dina. I know what it's like to have something on my body I don't want. So I called Dina up. Well, Dina came in. I said, Dina, we better do another commercial. So she does another one, and she says, hi, this is Dina. Remember me? The one that has something on her body she doesn't want. And it's not you, Charles Laquadera. And you hear him in the background going, whoa. Now, they started having this thing back and forth. Mm-hmm. This is my radio commercial.
So this is all recorded as a commercial.
This was just done on the air. Yeah, so we did that follow-up commercial of her saying, it's not you, because he was goofing on her. So I started getting all kinds of basically free exposure between the little rift between the two of them. So I got real lucky.
And what happened? Did you get slammed with phone calls?
We got slammed with phone calls.
This banter, though, was it recorded? How was it recorded? And how many times did they play that spot? Just once or twice?
Oh, no.
Over and over again?
Over and over and over.
Because she had to keep coming back, so she kept giving you advertising.
Sure. And we had a regular schedule with them anyways because it was working like crazy. It was him who did that. We never expected him to take a piece of our commercial and cut it out. Hi, I'm Dina. I know what it's like to have something on my body I don't want.
But he was playing that on the air.
Show.
On his show, not in a commercial.
Not in a commercial. He was just doing that to goof on her. He did that as a radio personality would goof on people.
Yeah, I understand. And then how long did that go on for?
Oh, that went on for a couple of months.
Oh, he kept doing that over and over again?
Over and over until we answered with her next commercial that said, it's not you. And then, again, you could hear him in the background going, oh, you know, or whatever he was saying. I forget what he was saying.
But when he was goofing, Laser Institute of New England, was that mentioned?
No.
That people remembered it when the next spot came on.
Well, that's the thing that it put it into people's mind, and it was us, and it was laser tattoo removal, and it was a fairly new service at the time. Anyways, what I learned from that whole experience is there's only one way to do radio advertising.
And that is?
Testimonial. An on-air personality testimonial. Everything else to me, it pales in comparison. Because if I'm going to spend money, and let's face it, if it's $500, I can get one response, no response, or seven responses. And if I can turn my response rate from one response to seven by doing a testimonial, well, that's the only way to go. And so I always advise all of my clients, if they're going to do radio, do a testimonial.
Have one of the personalities give a testimonial for your product or service.
Absolutely.
And there's a big radio station out here called KFI. It's an AM station out of L.A., and it's huge. And that's how they do their spots.
That's the only way to do it.
And they'll do that for you if you ask.
Yes.
You'll say, I want my spot to be a testimonial from one of the personalities rather than dream up some dumb skit or something.
That's right. And all of the advertising I was doing was failing. I mean, we'd just get a very marginal return, if that. I tried many, many different stations. I tried everything, but it wasn't until I found what worked. And again, by accident, but, you know, and again, of course, learning from Jay, what worked, it was night and day difference.
All right, so once you knew that, did you go out to other radio stations?
Yes. We tried it with different radio stations. Some are open to it. Some will charge a huge premium to have the personality do your message for you.
They will?
Yes, a huge premium. Definitely pay a premium for that.
Is it worth it?
It can be on the right station. But again, it goes back to who is your customer. You have to really understand who your customer is.
So that rock station was perfect.
I did other ones. Like if you just look purely at Arbitron, there was like a radio station here, Magic. Well, if you look at their numbers are huge. So, of course, before I knew better, I was advertising with them. I was getting nothing because magic is light, soft rock, meaning it's background music. It's playing in all the offices and all the phone systems and things like this, but nobody's listening to it. It's just background. Where with this, this was a testimonial. This woman started doing some of the concerts and everything, and she kind of became a little mini personality of her own, Dina. She was like Elvis, like, hi, I'm Dina. She had one name. It was very interesting.
So with the one with the background music, you tried it and it didn't work?
Never worked. I tried different stations, the country stations and things like that. They had a country station that had huge numbers. Never worked.
Where was some other success radio-wise?
Radio-wise?
Yeah.
Radio-wise, that was the only very, very successful program.
So did you keep doing that over and over again?
Oh, yeah, I kept doing that.
And that got you tons of customers?
Yes, it did. So between the newspaper, the Boston Herald, the blue-collar paper, mm-hmm. and the rock radio station, we did very, very well with laser tattoo removal. But that was the mixture that I had to find. And I tried many other things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went out to concerts. I used to do a lot of different things where we would go out and market and advertise. But the two that worked were the radio and that particular newspaper.
You were just able to target right to your market and get to the numbers.
That's right.
Just a side note, bring me up to 2009. Do they have anything that is just amazing for removing tattoos? Are the lasers still, you got to go back 6 or 7 times? Where's the stuff you rub on that's going to make the tattoo disappear?
Not going to happen.
Never?
No, not going to happen.
Is anyone working on something like that?
Oh, they're out there selling it.
That you rub on your tattoo?
Absolutely.
And it just doesn't work?
No.
People are buying that?
Sure they buy it.
I didn't know people are hustling stuff like that.
Absolutely. It's all over the internet. You can go on there and they'll guarantee that it'll work once you put it on, and it just doesn't work. It's because of how the process works. And tattooing itself is an unregulated business, which means that the quality of the ink is unknown, really, what they're doing. Now, one of the doctors at the Mass General Hospital actually came up with a ink that is laser friendly.
Really?
Absolutely. This guy's pretty incredible, but he came up with an ink where now if you were to go out and use that ink for your tattoo, you could remove that with a laser very quickly.
Did he try and market the ink?
Yeah.
And he does it, and tattoo parlors will offer that as an option?
I guess they do. Now, one of the things is it almost goes against the philosophy of getting a tattoo.
Yeah, once you do a tattoo, you're going permanent.
That's your mindset. What I found in my research of tattoos is that it's 5 years. Within 5 years of getting the tattoo, whoever you were 5 years ago, you're not that person anymore.
That's true.
Yeah. And this goes back to my original research of even starting the laser center. The most likely place to get a tattoo was the Marines, the Navy, were the top two places, you know, military, where you're going to get your first tattoo. Then all of a sudden it changed, and the most likely place to get your first tattoo is in college. And years ago, 12% of tattoos went to women. Now, today, I believe it's around 51 or 52%. So actually, a little bit more than half of the tattoos go to women. So you got a college-age girl getting a tattoo. Within 5 years, all of a sudden, she's out of school, she works at a bank, wherever she works, and she's got tattoos, and she doesn't think the same way she used to think.
She wants them off.
She wants them off. So what I found is, in the business, is when a woman comes in to get a tattoo removed, she's motivated totally different than a man, but they will keep all their appointments. They'll come in and do it. Where a man that came in for tattoo removal, he always came in almost every time because of a woman.
Oh, really? Because a woman wants it off.
Man will live with it. He doesn't care. He can find his way to spend money on something other than tattoo removal.
Yeah.
He'll keep a tattoo forever. Now, the other reason why people come in for tattoo removal was children. All of a sudden, the guy's got his cute little 3-year-old, and she looks up and goes, Daddy, what's that? And he's got this, whatever it may be. And he gets it off because now he's raising a family, and he'll do it for that reason. Where a woman comes in, they're much more focused, they're serious, they keep all their appointments.
And a woman's main reason is she's just a different person, and she's in a work environment, she just doesn't want it.
That's right.
That's fascinating.
And once they don't want it, they really don't want it.
Today, I mean, to me, it's just disgusting, all the people that have tattoos.
Here's the interesting thing about that. Very few people today are actually doing laser tattoo removal. When I started, remember I told you, there were only really two lasers out. There was the one for blood vessels, and then there was the one that did brown things and tattoos. Now, a lot of doctors think they don't want to deal with that tattoo-type person, and so they don't do tattoo removal. I tell people all the time, you're missing the boat.
Because they stereotype these people.
That's right, they stereotype.
And they're really normal people.
Salt of the earth. I loved the tattoo removal people. They were wonderful, reasonable expectations.
Yeah.
Average everyday working people. But what ended up happening is the entire industry changed in 1997.
All right, which industry? Laser?
Laser.
All right, tell me what.
In 1997, laser hair removal came out, and everything changed because so many people are a potential candidate for hair removal. Remember, I had told you that originally the only people that bought lasers were dermatologists and occasionally a plastic surgeon. When hair removal came out, the entire industry opened up. Now you started to see all kinds of people getting involved in this business. And every state had different laws on who could even operate some of these lasers, meaning a lot of times you didn't have to be only a physician to operate the laser. So business people started getting involved. And now you started to see a switch in the industry. A lot of new products started to come out, new lasers to treat additional problems, skin problems, and tattoo removal kind of went away.
The hair removal lasers wouldn't do the tattoos?
No. Even though, and here's another interesting thing, even though it was the exact same laser. Like, for instance, an Alexandrite laser is what we used for tattoo removal. An Alexandrite laser came up for hair removal. The exact same laser, a wavelength of 755, that one wouldn't do the same thing as the other because of the pulse duration of the laser.
Is a tattoo a faster pulse?
Yes. It's very short pulse, extremely short pulse, because the light passes through the skin, and it's almost like a photoacoustic effect. So what we're doing with a tattoo removal laser is the ink that gets injected into the body, when anything enters into the body's immune system attacks it. So your body tries to remove the tattoo the day it's put on. The problem is that the particles of ink are too large for your immune system to remove them. So what the body does to protect itself is it forms pockets around the ink, and it basically seals it off from the rest of the body. So the ink is now stuck in all these little pockets in your body. So what the laser does is what we're doing is we're breaking the ink down into tiny little particles. As soon as it's back into the body, the immune system attacks it again. The white blood cells go after it and, in effect, eat it. Carry it out of the body. That's why you can't remove a tattoo with a single treatment. We have to keep breaking the ink down into small enough particles where the body will remove it.
That's fascinating. Okay, so you're saying the laser tattoo business is very small right now?
I believe, because of what you said. Back in the 90s, there were a good number of people with tattoos, but nothing close. The industry went crazy. Everybody's got a tattoo today.
I'm telling you, the influx of people who want these tattoos now, there's got to be so many people who want them off.
Of course. There's a certain percentage of people that put them in the wrong place. My advice to a person always was, if you're going to get a tattoo, put it in a place where nobody will see it unless you want them to. But do not put it below the elbows. What happens if you have tattoos in your hand or your wrist and now all of a sudden you're selling high-end jewelry?
How are the lasers now for tattoo removal compared to in 96?
Better. Lasers have advanced fairly dramatically, but it's still the same lasers. And one of the biggest problems with the industry of tattoo removal is there's no one laser that you can remove all tattoos with because of the different colors. So you have to have at least two lasers to do it, at least.
So what do these lasers cost nowadays?
They're actually lower cost. The price of lasers has come way down compared to when I bought my first one.
So if you wanted to open up a tattoo removal place and you needed both lasers, what are you looking at?
Probably between $80,000 and $120,000.
And there's still no licensing? I mean, is there licensing in different states where you have to be licensed?
Every state is different on how they approach. Like, for instance, New Jersey had the toughest laws originally where only a doctor could operate a laser. So that actually hurt a lot of the businesses, for instance, like hair removal. Most doctors do not want to do hair removal. It's a very boring procedure to perform. The risks are very low, and they'll have their nurse or their practitioner or somebody else do it, but they're not going to do it. Well, in New Jersey, they had the law where only a physician could operate a laser. So now, you know what happens. If a doctor is going to provide the treatment as opposed to a practitioner, the price is going to be different. So what ended up happening is people from New Jersey would just go over to New York. New York was almost unregulated, and virtually anybody could be doing hair removal in New York. It became a big problem in the industry, and then now each state is dealing with the issue of who can operate a laser legally and who can't. And I know Florida's addressed it in a lot of them. But as far as tattoos go, it just would depend on the state that you're living in, who would be able to operate that laser. Obviously, have insurance, malpractice.
Yeah, all right, very interesting. I know we got off the subject. Let's take it back, but this is fascinating.
This is the end of part one. Please continue to part two.